Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Coming up, the Barber Kennel Gunlock Shelter has some terrific events going on to help them out, well, as well as raise awareness about what they do. So to talk about that, I have Mary Niemela here, return guest on Copper Country Today. It's always good to have you. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again, Rick.
You know, I get to see you out and about quite a bit, taking care of what you do, advocating for victims of domestic violence, yourself and also other people now from the shelter that I see from time to time. And usually when I do see you, a lot of times it's in a courtroom. And when there's a case going on for a domestic violence, there's a victim involved in there. Mm-hmm. I have always wondered, what does your presence or the presence from somebody's shelter mean, or when you're there, and what kind of service are you providing while you're there physically in a courtroom?
Well, that position is paid for through our STOP grant, which we received all shelters received in about 1995, 96. The STOP monies came through, and STOP stands for Services, Training, Officers, and Prosecution. And so those are the four areas that our STOP advocate works with. And I held that position for about 17 years of the time that I've been there. And that person, it allows us to have a person up in the courtroom advocating for the victim. I mean, prior to that, you know, the court really didn't know what to do with the victim. Often they would send them up to probation if the defendant pled guilty, to talk to the probation officer with the defendant. And boy, talk about intimidating. You know, you're not going to say really what happened if you're sitting there or even outside the room with somebody who's just been abusive to you. And so our funders down at the in Lansing from the DV board had looked for years on how to get somebody in that position. And finally the monies came through. It's a federal grant. And so we've held that grant for the last 17 or more than that, 18 years now. And this is the first time it had been written since 2009. So I had to write that this year. And we just recently found out that we received it. We had a little bit of reduction in monies, but it's still enough to, you know, help us along and do what we have to do in the court system. So back to your question as to what is it that we do as advocates, and basically it's our presence there. It's where kind of the liaison between the victim and the courts, and making sure that she's being well taken care of as far as, and I say she because 95% of the abuses against women as reported cases in the United States. I think I've had the opportunity to say that in every time I've ever spoken on the radio with you.
Well, it's always good to bring up again, so that people understand what we are talking about.
Yeah, we do provide services for males as well if they're victims of domestic violence, and we would provide that service in the court as well. And so a lot of times that advocate will work with the victim or sit with her basically while the court proceeding is going on, if not in the courtroom, but down in the prosecutor's office there to keep her safe and away from the situation if she chooses to do so. And also that advocate can help with personal protection orders. If you hear the term PPO, that's what that acronym stands for, is personal protection order. They used to be called restraining orders, and so they changed the name a little bit to personal protection order. And not only just with the domestic violence PPOs, but also is the stalking PPOs as well. And we can help with that and help the victim fill it out and make it sure it's filled out properly before she turns it in, because, you know, what she wants to be said is maybe not enough or maybe too much or not the right thing. So we have to be able to explain what that personal protection order is and how to fill it out. And that's what one of the things the advocate can do. Also, she meets with people at the shelter and helps with housing and all the other services that we provide at the shelter besides the safety and care of the client.
Referring to PPOs, I'm sometimes surprised when there's been a violent domestic abuse crime and somebody is facing charges that the court will impose a no contact order, right, between the victim and the perpetrator. And oftentimes, I've seen it plenty, you know, well more than once with the victim there. She is there advocating to have the no contact order lifted,
right.
So she can have contact with the fellow who is facing charges for, you know, having some sort of a, you know, abusive action towards her, and she's the one doing the, you know, saying no, I want him back, I want him, you know, with me. We were both drunk or whatever it is, and you know, possibly arguing against her own self-interest.
I'm glad you brought that up, and it's sad to say we only have a half hour to talk about that, because that's a huge concern from everybody that witnesses that happening, and including us as well, because, and the judge, because the safety, that no contact order was put on for the safety of the victim, and she realizes that, and however, and we've said this many times before too, is that you know, the victim still loves the abuser. Which is her husband often, or her boyfriend, or you know, they either live together or whatever, they're in a relationship. But it's the behavior and belief that she doesn't like. And so she often feels that if she can talk with him, maybe she can get him to change his ways, or to maybe they have children and they feel that they have to have contact. And so... until we can understand that from her point of view, it's going to be difficult for any of us to say, well, why is that no contact order getting lifted? I myself have advocated not to have it lifted at times, just because I know of the situation and I know the severity of it, and I know the MO say of what an abuser is going to do, and because he's promising that he's not going to do it again doesn't necessarily mean that that's what it's going to happen. And so often if the personal protection, or excuse me, the no contact order is dropped, often there's a reoffense, and then he's back there facing more charges. And or if he's given a delay of sentence and that no contact order is violated, or he reoffends if it's been dropped, then that delay of sentence is off the table. And often we get said, well, it doesn't matter, she's going to let him back in anyway, they might as well drop it. But in reality, what we have to really say is, why does he go back into that situation? Why is he going to do that instead of saying she's letting him back in? We know why she's going to let him back in, because she still loves him. And again, she doesn't love the behavior, but she loves him, and she feels that maybe she can get him to stop doing what he's doing. But same thing with a PPO, when they're being asked to being dropped or it's violated. I mean, one of the first things we hear is, well, she let him back in. Well, my question is, why did he go there? If he's not going to continue with the power and control that he was doing when that got him into trouble in the first place, or the abusiveness. So we have to put that ownership back on the defendant. And the same thing as gets asked is, why does she leave? Why doesn't she just leave? What we should be asking is, why does he abuse? You know, and by saying, why doesn't she leave, or why does she do this? That's saying what he's doing is okay. It's just that it's her responsibility to stop it. And that's not true. She can't do that. And it's the same thing with alcohol. I mean, it's two separate issues. If you took away the alcohol, you'd have a sober batterer. It's just an excuse. So no contact orders are a tough decision. We all understand that she needs to talk to him and she needs to do that, but she can do that through attorneys if there's attorneys involved, or the prosecutor and his attorney. And I don't know how that behavior is going to stop.
Well, with attorneys, oftentimes the person who's got charges filed against them, they get a court-appointed attorney. So how does the victim get representation?
Through the prosecutor.
If
he has an attorney and the prosecutor would represent her in that situation, he's the one prosecuting the case, so she'd be the one, he'd be the one, or he or she, whoever is handling the case, would be the one to handle that, answer her questions.
Yeah, you brought up the question of why, and it goes back to a point that I've been making for the couple of years that we've been talking on this program. As little children, you know, it wasn't there. There was a poster one time that said all the things I've ever needed to know in life I learned when I was in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. We're taught as little children while playing in the sandbox, you know, as a boy, you do not hit a girl.
Right.
Now, you really shouldn't be hitting anybody, but, you know, as young children, you are, that is ingrained into, you know, into young boys that you do not hit a girl. And you grow up, you know, you do not hit a girl. So how some of these people become men and then some if somehow find any sort of justification to lay their hands on a woman is beyond me. It's something I can't wrap my head around. You know, I'm married, and sometimes I've been very upset at my wife, but I would never, would occur to me never to lay hands on her or any woman. So why that becomes such a quick and easy choice for those who are inclined to batter, you know, I as with any sort of criminal behavior, and that's what domestic violence is a criminal activity. It's,
that's right.
It's not being inclined that way. I do not understand what would lead a person down that path to do that and then do it repeatedly.
Well, often they're not being held accountable for it, whether the case that, you know, that maybe the situation, whatever happened, wasn't called into the police or nobody else witnessed it. I mean, for a victim to come forward, it's happened a lot. Before she, you know, maybe either somebody else notices and calls it in, or she just says, "That's it. I've had it. I'm done. I can't do it anymore," and either leaves or maybe ends up calling the police because he's gone a little too far this time, in her opinion. And so we just have to wait for that to happen at times, because no matter what we say to the person, when she leaves, it's going to be her time to leave. And it's not a safe time for her to leave from all the threats that maybe he's given. If you leave, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. But, you know, domestic violence is a choice. It's a learned behavior. It's passed on from generation to generation. And unless he's held accountable for that behavior, he's going to continue. He's going to continue to get away with it. And not all domestic violence is physical either. It starts out emotional, very mental abuse, as far as calling them names or making them feel bad about themselves, or, you know, threatening them. If you say something, I'm going to talk to your parents. I'm going to tell them at work. I'm going to, you know, if you leave me, I'm going to take the kids. There's all those threats out there. You'll have nowhere to live. You have no money. I won't let you have this. I won't let you have that. And, you know, all of that, except your children are material. I mean, your children are not material things. They're part of your life, but you know, all those other things can be replaced. But to lose your, or to have her think that maybe he might take the kids, is devastating to her, which is a huge reason why women stay in that situation. And he might be a good dad to the kids. You know, it's hard to believe that if somebody's being abusive. You know, there's a new model coming through about domestic violence and when there's children involved, and the concept is going to be is, you know, why with the abuser, often they're separated and the children stay with one parent or the other if there's domestic violence, and holding the father more accountable is to say, why don't you think you have to support that child? You know, you can't just walk away from being a dad or a father. You still have to support that child. And part of that is not being abusive in front of the mother or to the children, or not supporting them financially. You still have to do that. And your behavior doesn't mean that you are off the hook from all those things, you know. And so in basically domestic violence is a learned behavior, and it's a choice, and it's going to continue until somebody holds them accountable. I mean, we have a batterers program in our community through Dial Help, and people can get into it without being mandated through the court systems. And boy, that would be, to me, a more believable person that could seek out their own help rather than being mandated by court.
Talking right now with Mary Niemela. She's the director of the Barbara Kettle Gunlock Shelter Home. It is a wonderful service, a very, unfortunately, very necessary service that provides sanctuary for victims of domestic violence, for women who can go there, get out of the situation that they're in, and get some help taking those next steps in order to rectify the situation, basically keep her safe through this whole process. Now, it would be lovely if that was able to be done for free, but it costs money to do that, not for the victim, but for the shelter home as well, for them.
Correct.
So you have to do some fundraising You got a couple of events here that help to raise both funds and awareness, and let's talk about them.
Well, interesting enough, you say the fundraisers, and neither one of them are truly a fundraiser, but in a sense, I guess it is. I mean, this is our 35th anniversary year of being a funded shelter, and we decided that we would celebrate that with a dinner. And so on October 6th, which is a Tuesday night, we are having a dinner at the Siskowit Reception Hall in Calumet, and it's on M203 or Pine Street, depending on if you where you live. In Calumet, it's on Pine Street. Yeah.
And this is the new building that's recently been built. It's next to the
Erickson Crowley Peterson Funeral Home. Yeah, funeral home. Right? Joel built that building there, and it's a beautiful building. Great. It has a wonderful kitchen in it. And our dinner is going to be served by Connie's Kitchen in Calumet. And we've got a wonderful menu of both vegetarian and turkey and dressing and roast beef and mashed potatoes and mostaccioli with marinara sauce on it and salads and vegetables and desserts. And it's going to be a wonderful night. The cost for that is $20, which is basically covering the cost that we need to do that. We just want to have this to be a celebratory dinner. And we are going to do that again on Tuesday, October 6th. To make reservations, all you have to do is call the shelter at 337-5632, or you can email the shelter at bkghome@pasti.com. And we'd like that to be by October 1st, so Connie has time to prepare for the meal. And we do have a speaker, and her name is Debbie Kane. She's the executive director of the MDSV-PTB, which is an acronym for the Michigan Domestic Sexual Violence Prevention and Treatment Board, which is our main funders. And she's coming up from Lansing, and she'll be talking to us for a little bit about why shelters need funding. And of course, ours has been going for 35 years, and it actually started a year before in a woman's home, but the state stepped in 1980 and asked if we would wanted to be funded by them and follow their guidelines, of course, and their standards. And we've done that. And we moved into our present building in 1983, but we were actually funded in 1980 already.
Was that woman Barbara Kettle Gunlock?
That's correct.
I never heard the story. I didn't know that.
Well, Winks, Herman Gunlock donated it in 1983, the year Barbara died. And named the facility after her because she was an activist in women's issues. And it's been that ever since, and it will be continue no matter where we are. So,
all right. So you have that on Tuesday, October 6th, the dinner at Siskowit Reception Hall in Calumet. It was a great dinner, a nice, good, nice speaker for $20.
And I think the Siskowit, if I'm not mistaken, stands for fatty fish or flattened fish or something like that. Flabby fish, I'm not sure. I have to ask Joel about that. But it's got nothing to do with what our menu is. So.
Okay. Then the day before, you have the Riot Against Abuse. This you started last year, I believe. So it's the second year you have this going on, a motorcycle ride. Starts off here. Yeah, I was thinking, this is what I get for reading on air.
So why don't I let you take it then? Okay. This is our second annual Ride Against Abuse. Every year, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we usually had some sort of vigil on the first Monday of the month, which is the Day of Unity. So all across the nation, shelters are doing something, not necessarily everybody on that day, but I think a lot of them do. And so we've kind of always picked the first Monday of the month as well. And I thought last year, let's make some noise. And so we did. I thought, let's have a motorcycle ride in. So, you know, I was expecting, maybe a couple of bikes or whatever. I know some people that said, maybe they'll come up. Well, we're standing in front of the American. It was a beautiful night. And it snowed a little bit, slushy snow, about a week and a half before that. And I thought, but it was a beautiful night. I believe last year was October 6th. And all of a sudden, bike after bike kept coming in, and we ended up with 23 bikes. And Diane's the manager at the American, and she had coffee out there for us. And we had a little bit of a ceremony beforehand just to start off to talk to the people about why we're there. And and to, you know, support and mourning the victims and celebrating the survivors of domestic violence, and talk a little bit about the shelter and why we're there. And so then after that, we had a police escort, the state police, the Houghton County Sheriff's Department, and Houghton City, Hancock City. They were all great in helping us out. And we left Calumet. We didn't stop at the stoplight in Calumet and on Mine Street and 41. The state police were there. The sheriff's department was in the front of us. And I rode in my vehicle behind all the bikers in front of the state police then on the way to Houghton. And it was an awesome scene to see those bikes. I mean, you know, people who ride motorcycles obviously know what they're doing, because when we got onto the four-lane area between Hancock and Calumet, they separated so nobody could pass them and stayed on the two lanes, all the bikes. And we got rode that way all the way through Hancock and Houghton. We went up and around Montezuma, came down Sheldon, didn't stop at that stoplight either, and Houghton City had stopped the traffic on the bridge so we could continue right on to Kestner Park without having to stop. And that's where we ended, and it was just the most awesome thing. And everybody got off their bikes, and I mean, they parked in perfect order, and I just jumped out of my vehicle in the middle of the parking lot, because it was just, I had to get out and talk to them. It was great to have all that support. And of course, they were all excited about doing it again this year, and I hope all of those plus more even will come out again this year and do that with us, and just raise that awareness, and people along the streets too. I really hope that people can come out of their homes or their businesses or whatever and just wave at us and show their support for the shelter that way. And I know you and I have talked about possibly being up on Veterans Park and having pictures taken there, or being on the TV. And so we'll hope that happens and create an awareness, just not for our local area, but for everybody to see what can be done.
Mm. Well, with the September we've had, I don't think you'll have to worry about slushy snow before October.
Isn't that great?
Which also may mean that, you know, face it, when the weather goes bad, a lot of people put the bikes in the garage and cover them up for the year. And so with the warmer weather that we've had, perhaps a lot of people still have their bikes out and are looking for one last ride through town. And so we encourage everybody, if you got a bike, get out there and get in this.
Right. And there's no fee. And I mean, you can just show up. You don't have to call us and tell us you're coming. If you want to, that's fine. But I gave everybody a purple bandana last year. So if you rode in the ride last year, you could bring your purple bandana. I have more again for this year for those that didn't get one or maybe forgot to bring theirs. And so I know last year we all talked about, well, what should we call ourselves? And so I'm considering them to be the ADV Riders, Against Domestic Violence Riders, is what they had talked about. So if we continue to get this support, I understand patches are a big thing for bikers, so we'll see what we can do for future years on that.
Now, as always, our conversations go by pretty quick, and I only have about 2 minutes left, but you mentioned about how busy you've been and said some numbers. I wanted to have you get a chance to share those so people know how important it is to take part in these events and help create awareness.
Well, we're coming up on the end of our fiscal year, which ends in September, and we've been very busy all year. I don't think we've had an empty night, oh gosh, maybe even more than a year and a half. And right now, at the end of August, our shelter nights are 2,193 shelter nights. And in the fiscal year 13-14, our total nights were 571 for the whole year. And by the first 6 months of this year, we had over 1,600 shelter nights. And a shelter night is, say, if a woman and three children come in, that's four shelter nights for every night she's there. And so we've been extremely busy, you know, and we've had multiple denials. And denial is if a woman, we're at our capacity, which we're a 10-bed shelter, and it's a victim of domestic violence. And we had 14 just in April alone, and seven in May. And so those numbers have been dwindling down. So either people are finding another place, and we do certainly help them try to find another shelter within our area. There's seven shelters in the UP, so 46 in the state. And so we try to get them to another shelter if need be, if that's where they have to go, or maybe they can stay where they are another night if it's not with the abuser. So we've been very busy. I mean, we've had over 450 crisis calls, and just the numbers have been astounding this year.
That is definitely astounding. I want to encourage everybody to sign up for the dinner at the Siskiwit Reception Hall that takes place October 6th. They would like you to reserve your spot by October 1st. It's only $20, well worth the food and the speaker. So definitely take part in that. Their 35th anniversary dinner for the Barbara Kittle Gunlock Shelter Home. And then on Monday, October 5th, take part in the second annual Ride Against Abuse. That's got to keep this in the spotlight and keep people aware until the last abuser stops. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Cover Country Today. We'll be right back.